Hello, and welcome to the Yale Press podcast addendum interview with Léonie Gombrich, granddaughter of E.H. Gombrich, the author of A Little History of the World. I'm your host, Chris Gondek. This is the full interview conducted on January 25th, 2007. An edited version was originally part of the February 2007 edition of the show. Léonie Gombrich, thank you so much for being on the Yale Press podcast today.
Well, thank you for having me.
What was your grandfather's aim in writing this book?
Well, I think that what he wanted to prove to himself was that it would be possible to explain any concept, no matter how complicated, up to a point, to a child if you used clear and kind of friendly enough language to do so. And his great hero was the Irish satirist Jonathan Swift. And I don't know if it's an apocryphal tale, but my grandfather used to tell us that Swift was known for when he had written something, he would ask all the members of his household, meaning, you know, the servants and the scullery maid and the butler, and who all had different degrees of education and many none at all, to come in, and he would read to them what he had written. And if any one of them couldn't understand it, then he would rewrite it until they could. And this was my grandfather's model for clarity of writing. So I think that was one of the things that he wanted to do.
Wasn't there also a story that before your grandfather took on this assignment that he was writing to a young girl trying to explain to her what he was doing?
Yes, that's absolutely true. He had some friends of his had a little daughter. I think she must have been about 8 or 9 years old. And I'm not sure who they were. I don't know their name. But anyway, he apparently, when he was a PhD student, he used to come around to their house pretty often. And when he got into the writing up part of the PhD and they didn't see him so often, their daughter wanted to know where he was. He was obviously something of a favorite of hers. And so he wrote her at first just a little note to say what he was up to and why he wasn't coming around for dinner. And what he ended up doing in writing to her was trying to tell her what his PhD was about, which was about Giulio Romano's frescoes in the Palazzo del Te in Mantova, in language that she would enjoy and understand, which indeed she did, and he enjoyed doing it. And so that was one of the things that gave him, when he got the commission to write the book, that gave him the confidence to think that he might be able to do it.
So now about this commission, it's a pretty famous story about how an English publisher went to him to try to get him to write a book. Would you mind telling it?
Yes. What happened was the publisher was Austrian who first approached him, but it was an acquaintance of his, Thomas Neurath, who later went on to start the Thames and Hudson Press in London. Was then working as an editor for a publisher in Vienna, and he wanted to start a series of books called Wissenschaft für Kinder, Knowledge for Children. And they, by a mutual friend, he had been sent an English history book, and he approached my grandfather and asked him if he would take a look at it and see whether he would like the job of translating it, and indeed whether he thought it was a good book and worth translating. And my grandfather took one look at it and just thought it was absolute rubbish. And in trying to describe that he didn't think it was very good, he said to Neurath, you know, it's so bad, I think I could write a better one myself, almost just as a figure of speech. And Neurath said, if you really think you could write one yourself, I would like to see you do it. And so my grandfather, who'd had this experience that we mentioned earlier about writing to the daughter of friends, did a sample chapter for him. I think it was the chapter on the age of chivalry, and showed it to Neurath, and Neurath thought it was great and said, I would love you to write the book. The only trouble is he was still on the translation schedule, which is considerably shorter than a writing schedule, and he said, I do need the book in 6 weeks' time. Do you think you can do it? So my grandfather took it on almost as a dare. He was unemployed at the time. He'd got his PhD and no prospect of a job, and he just sort of plotted it out like a military campaign and to see if he could pull it off, which indeed he did.
What was your grandmother's role in this?
Well, they had known each other for some years. I suppose you would say they were courting, though I don't know if anything was so explicit, but they weren't yet. It was a year before they married, and certainly they were in the habit already of every weekend going for walks or going for excursions, and they often went to walk in the Wienerwald, which is the woods outside Vienna. Also because a lot of their friends used to go skiing, and my grandmother was a pianist, and she was rather sporty, but the one time she went skiing, she fell over and hurt her arm, and she thought, hang on, this would be a bit stupid if I were to sacrifice my career for my kind of Sunday activities, which is where the walks came from, because my grandfather said, I don't mind giving up the prospect of skiing, let's walk. they were walking in the Wienerwald, and she says... the way she would tell the story, she said one Sunday he would pull this great kind of crumpled sheaf of papers out of his breast pocket and said, do you mind if I read you something that I've started? And she said, no, of course, that'd be nice. And she said, well, it was lucky that he read it because his handwriting was always terrible, and that is indeed true. And she obviously did like it. It was the first chapter that he had written of The Little History of the World, and he proceeded to read the whole of it to her over the following 6 weeks, as he would write during the week, and on the Sunday on their weekly excursion, they would take a break and he would read the chunk of the book that he had completed that week. And I really think that the fact that it was all read aloud in the course of the writing has had an enormous impact on the way it reads, and it absolutely... It's just completely his voice, the way he talked, that totally works. And when you read it, it does beg to be read aloud, actually. So
I would quite agree. It's nice on the written page, but hearing someone speak it, it's really very nice.
Yeah.
I would like to point out to everybody that this book also won, I guess, the 20th Century Award for a book that must be taken seriously because the Nazis banned it.
Yes. The Nazis banned it because they thought it was too pacifist. It does have, I mean, it's certainly not pro-war. I mean, for a book which deals a lot with military history, with the great conquests of the world, he definitely takes very much the kind of view of the little man, the people in the ravaged villages and all that, every time a great conqueror sweeps the globe. And that, of course, did not go well with the Nazis' triumphalist view of history and German destiny and all that, and so that was their reason for banning the book.
Bit of a badge of honor, one would think, though, having your book banned by the Nazis.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, yes, I suppose you'd be rather upset if it weren't.
your grandfather, E.H. Gombrich, is probably best known as one of the 20th century's great art historians, and most people may know him for the book The Story of Art. Is there a relationship between the two books?
There certainly is. It's a strong relationship, both sort of positive and as a reaction. When The Little History came out in Vienna, and then it was a surprise success, and it was translated into several languages at the time, my grandfather was actually asked by Norat to write a version that was about art history for children, and I think he did scribble a few things down, but then he abandoned it, saying he didn't think that art history was a subject for children. Then during the war, when he was in England, he was approached by another so-called exile publisher, Bela Horowitz, who founded the Fiden Press, again with a similar proposal. Horowitz knew the little history and wanted a version that was about art history. And my grandfather said he would write one for slightly older children, for adolescents and for students, because, again, he didn't feel that it was a subject for children. And he wrote a sample chapter, and Horowitz's daughter read it and liked it, and that became The Story of Art. And it's subtle, but the difference in his approach to those two themes, history and art history, it's all in the title, the difference, because it's he uses a difference which is not present in German nor indeed in I think any of the European languages, the difference between history and story. Because his point about a history is there's a past, there's a whole load of facts and what happened. And every time you write a history, you choose what you decide to put together to make your own history. Whereas the story of art is the story of a tradition. And so one thing relies, something that happens relies on the thing that happened before. So it's an important difference for him because it's the difference between cause and effect, which is implicit in story, and the choice of the author, which is what happens with the history. And in a sense, it's a reaction to, well, you mentioned the Nazis, where the Nazis tried to portray this view of history as events being inevitable. And in their view of history, then the rise of Germany, you know, under Nazism to take over the rest of the world was inevitable. There was a destiny about it. Whereas his view of history was that that is absolutely not the case. We choose what happens next, and we choose how we interpret the events of the past, how we link one thing to another. Whereas when it comes to particular kinds of human achievement, cultural achievement, you do rely on what went before.
There was a stretch of time between when this book was initially published in Austria and when there was an English language edition. Why did he finally decide to put out an English language edition?
Well, he'd been asked for an English language edition, as you can probably imagine, for many years, by the time he actually got round to it. I mean, the book was forgotten and lay in a drawer until the mid-80s, when the German publisher, Dumont, having made a mistake, in fact, in wanting to translate to the story of art into German, which had already been done, wrote and asked about this book, and he sent it to them saying, "Are you sure you mean this is what you want?" And they said no, but, you know, we'd love to publish it. So it came out again, having been out of print since the Nazis banned it, in the mid-80s, and then when it was again a success, so he was approached many times. But by then, in the mid-1980s, he was a very well-known scholar and art historian with an extremely busy lecturing schedule and lots and lots of things that he himself wanted to research and write about. And he didn't want the book to come out in English unless he did it himself. It's the only full-length book that he ever wrote in German. He wrote all his other books in English. And I think he didn't really trust anyone else with his voice. He wanted to do it himself. And also, he probably would have wanted to make changes to what he wrote about. I mean, this happens in all the translations of The Little History. The French have a little more about Napoleon, the Italians have a little more about Garibaldi, and we know that for the English language he wanted to do a chapter on Shakespeare. I'm sure he would have done a little bit more about the Glorious Revolution. He would have certainly, I know he wanted to write more about the Bill of Rights and the founding of the Republic. So he wanted to do it himself, and he just literally didn't have the time. He worked until his death. So it was only in the year that he eventually died that he had got going with it.
Did you ever get a chance to visit him while he was working on the book?
Oh, absolutely. I visit him every week, at least every week. And when he began on it again, it was very jolly. It was a very cheery moment. He'd just turned in the manuscript for Preface for the Primitive, which is the book he'd been working on for the previous 10 years, and didn't know if he would ever get finished. He got it finished, and my grandmother had actually been running a backroom campaign for him to work on the English translation of The Little History. I mean, she was very fond of it for obvious reasons, and she sort of saw a gap in the schedule, as it were. I mean, he was by then, you know, 91, but and she'd been saying, "Oh, you know, I think it'd be wonderful if Ernst would now do the English translation of this." And I've said so, but, you know, do encourage him if he brings it up and all this kind of thing. And then he started reread it in order to kind of get going on it, and he was really delighted with it. I think he had thought that there would be a lot more he would need to do, and in fact, he said that, you know, "I've been rereading My Little History, and it's, you know, it's really very good." Yeah, so I think, and he had translated, at least in first draft, a fair proportion of it by the time he died, and he was having fun with it. I think it was a book that he always had fun with.
Now, have you, or do you know any stories of whether he'd ever heard from children about this book?
I don't know about him hearing from children as children, but I do know that people wrote to him who, when it came out again, who had known it when they were children, and they were now adults and were just absolutely overjoyed to, you know, to see it come back and to be able to give it to children that they knew. I don't have any letters in his collection that actually kind of written in childish script, but as I say, the grown children remembered it very fondly.
And what did he think about those letters?
Oh, he was delighted about that. I mean, you know, I suppose any author would be, and in a way particularly, He'd written for such a different audience for most of his life, although he's best known for The Story of Art. He, of course, he always said he had a schizophrenic career. Most of his serious colleagues had never read The Story of Art, and most of the readers of The Story of Art had never read most of his other stuff. So it was just such a different and kind of more heartfelt, I suppose, kind of market that he was, or kind of audience that he was writing for. So it was just, you know, pure pleasure to hear that he'd had that kind of effect on people.
Well, so people can hear what it sounds like. I was wondering if you could read the section when your grandfather talks about the triumph of reason in the 18th century.
Now, if reason is given to all, it must follow that all people are of equal worth. And as you remember, that was just what Christianity had taught, that all men are equal before God. But those who preached tolerance and reason took this argument one step further. They didn't only teach that all people were essentially equal, they demanded that they be treated equally as well. That every human being, as God's creature, endowed by him with reason, had rights that no one might or should deny him. The right to choose his own calling and to choose how he lived, and the freedom to act or not to act as his reason and his conscience dictated. Children, too, should be taught not with the cane, but with reason, so that they might come to understand the difference between right and wrong. And criminals were human beings, too. No doubt they'd done wrong, but they could still be helped to mend their ways. It was dreadful, they argued, to brand a man's cheek or forehead with a red-hot iron for one wrongdoing, leaving a mark he would bear for the rest of his life, so that all might say, that man is a criminal. There was something, they said, which forbade a person to be publicly humiliated. It was called human dignity.
And that was Léonie Gombrich, talking about her grandfather E.H. Gombrich's book, A Little History of the World, which is published by Yale University Press in 2005. For more information about this and other titles, go to the website, www.yalebooks.com.